Hello, and welcome to this month's edition of the Zeitgeist Tapes, where myself, Emma Burnell, a political journalist, and academic Steve Fielding. Hello, Steve.
Hello from the academic community.
Every month we take a piece of popular culture and look at how it tackles political issues or indeed the coverage of politicians themselves. So this month we are looking at the 1 hour long BBC drama called The Left Behind, which looks at the radicalisation of the far right, people who get radicalised into the far right. Was it Swansea?
Apparently it was Cardiff.
Cardiff, I'm so sorry.
I discovered in my internet research, but it's South Wales.
I apologise, and it's probably people in London not knowing the difference between Swansea and Cardiff that radicalises people. So, Steve, tell us a little bit about The Left Behind.
Well, it says it's a kind of drama documentary that it's based on fact. I mean, it is based on some research that another academic did for a book on the English Defence League. And although, I mean, the extent to which it's based on fact is the fact that, as it says at the start and at the end, there has been a spike in hate crimes, a significant spike in hate crimes, a significant number of cases referred to the, I forget what the government agency is called, a sort of far right radicalisation. So it centres it's all fiction, but it centres on a character who, I guess we're meant to understand is kind of a fairly typical kind of a person. At least that is the presumption of the drama. A typical kind of person who's attracted to the far right. Gethin is a lovely chap, isn't he? He's a lovely young lad.
He is. It's kind of heartbreaking. Because he is, he's a good brother. He's a good co-worker.
Yes,
and he's just trying, and at every turn things go wrong for him.
Yeah, so he finds by the end of the documentary of the drama, he's kind of lost his job. He's only on 0 hours contract anyway, but he's lost his shifts, and he's lost. His home, because he was sharing with his sister and her family, and they were being evicted, and the only accommodation they could get was in a family hostel, which meant he could not be accommodated. The system couldn't find him anywhere to live, so he was just homeless. So it's a very desperate. Emma and I saw it separately, and we both came to the conclusion it's really depressing.
It's
really sad story,
and it does a lot to humanise people who we do have a tendency to dehumanise, I suppose. You know, the far right, and you know, Gethin and his friends are thugs by the end of it. They, they behave in ways that we would completely and utterly condemn, and rightly so. But you don't start off that way with Gethin. So you watch his journey and you watch him spiral. And you watch his hopelessness as, you know, he's endlessly told, you're not a priority. You know, he's not a priority at his work, so he can't get enough shifts. He's not a priority in terms of trying to get housing. You know, he's told straight up, you know, single white male with no dependents, you're not going to get anywhere on the housing list.
Yes. And you know, obviously it's a drama, so I think maybe... There's some slight exaggeration, and there are some things in there which I'm not entirely sure reflect the reality of those who are radicalised by the far right.
I felt the timescale was a little unrealistic. He seemed to be radicalised in about 2 weeks.
Yeah, if that actually. I mean, because we say, he starts off a lovely young man, and even though there's an empty council house in front of where his sister is living, and they believe that should be theirs. You know, there's a sense. It's a kind of bit Blue Labour-ish in the sense that there are these people who are from that part of Cardiff, and this is their city, and then they see. Basically Muslims, although sometimes it's just immigrants, it's not, you know, but it centres on Muslims. So taking our homes, and the family that takes over, moves into this council house, also sets up a halal butchers, which again it's where they take over our shops, and you know, they're taking our jobs, and that's often evoked. Although Gethin, it establishes a relationship with it's Yaz, isn't it, who's actually part of the family that moves in to the house that his sister believes really that should be their home. So it's really, it is a bit incredible in terms of how quickly it happens. That has to be said. But also the group of friends that he's with. I mean, there's two of the lads, two of the white boys, I think, and then there's a black lesbian who's part of the gang, or at least mixed race lesbian. And she becomes radicalized. I mean, you sometimes see on her face when the discussion goes from Muslims to immigrants, she looks a bit uneasy, but then she then focuses it back onto the Muslims and says, well, they hate gays and they hate women, so I'm basically, you know, screwed. So I'm not quite sure how many black lesbians become, you know, radicalized, but I think a point was being made, wasn't it, by the dramatist, by including that kind of a character.
Yeah, and I think I was reading the other day, actually, that there was a movement within the EDL to focus on gay people, to try and radicalise them against Muslims, and you know, that kind of divisiveness. So I think that you know, that point is I think backed up at least in some way by the by the facts. I don't know whether that was women so often as gay men. But definitely that was a thing. The authority, the bureaucracy is portrayed throughout as very unfeeling and heartless in this. And you there's the woman at the housing office, who presumably is DWP, who just, you know, very much computer says no. And you sort of sense that behind that there is, you know, she does sense his desperation, but there's nothing she can do. And then the councillor who speaks to a meeting about a new housing estate that's being built just seems to come up with platitudes, doesn't she?
Yeah, there are kind of, I think, three authority figures in the drama. The first is the woman from the DWP. And I slightly disagree with you in terms of understanding her. I think basically she is trying to do her best, but the system doesn't allow her to do anything for Gethin. I mean, she says, you know, as a single male, no dependents, the system doesn't allow her to help him.
And yeah, I mean, I think she feels it, but I mean, it must be so... To do that job must be so difficult. You would have to turn it off, because otherwise, how could you cope?
So there's her, and I mean, in a long, I mean, she's certainly not as unsympathetic as I'm, because I'm just thinking of characters in that position in the past, like Bread. I don't know if you remember Bread.
Yes, I remember Bread very well.
Yeah,
Joey Boswell.
The youngsters, Bread. Google that, people. So she wasn't very sympathetic. She was certainly more sympathetic than that character in Bread. But then you're absolutely right. I thought the counsellor was awful. I mean, she was like a pro vice chancellor for teaching and learning at any university, you know, any other bureaucrat that just comes out with all sorts of platitudes. That's a great question, you know, that kind of stuff. She didn't quite say, I can hear what you're saying, but she might as well have done. And she was the point is, she's the counsellor. And the scene in which she features is when they're unveiling this great new housing scheme, because the drama makes a big point that there are lots of people who have got no homes. You know, they've been on waiting list for years and years and years, and so along comes this scheme with this great new video that's a private, you know, it's a private initiative, and the council has obviously given them something in return for a percentage of affordable.
Well, it'll be Section 106 money, won't it? You have to build a percentage of affordable housing in order to get planning permission.
So I don't know if that's worth showing doing an early clip, because it's actually quite an interesting way in which that's presented.
Yeah, let's have a listen to that now.
Home is a sanctuary for families, for communities. Your council and Drakefield Homes have taken it as our mission to provide these needs. Welcome to the future. Welcome to Pentre Porth.
Good Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning. I am Councillor Andrea Watkins. Lovely to meet you all. It's fantastic to see so many local faces. Let me introduce you to the panel. We have Carol Hodgkins, who is on the City Planning Development Board. And we have our CEO of Drakefield Homes, Andrew Higgs, is also here today. Our commitment is to bring new life to this area, new faces and income strands. That's why we're here.
How many of these homes are available to the people who already lives in the area, like the locals?
What's your name?
Lisa.
Lisa, that's a great question. Thank you very much. So we are currently in discussion with Drakefield about what's viable, but we are working with a 30% target for social housing.
I want to know how many houses there are going to be. I don't want to know 30%. I want to know how many houses.
When you say 30%, if you build 60 houses on that plot, that's only 20 houses that are going to be for what you call affordable. Yeah. That's not even going to cover the people in this room.
In this current climate, we have to start at 30%, and I will be working my hardest. As your councillor, I will be working my hardest to take that forward.
And you still can't tell us even what 30% is.
10 years ago, they built affordable houses, and we heard about 30%. In N, it was count 10% for local people. And a lot of them couldn't afford it. And a lot of them had already been evicted from their homes. And all the houses were sold to people who drive Rolls Royces or whatever.
I work full time, and I've been homeless for 4 years. Ah. I mean, what sort of lists have you got going? What have you got to do to get on this magic 30%?
In this day and age, it is unacceptable for somebody like yourself to be working and homeless. That is something we need to eradicate. Now, I will be taking that forward so we can escalate that further.
Can you just tell us what affordable is?
Affordability, I'm really glad you brought that up.
It says in the brochure that the flat prices start at 178,000. I can't afford that. Can anybody here afford that?
No. When you say affordable, obviously you're talking about buying, right? And what about for rent?
Sorry, I didn't catch your name.
It's Geth.
Gethin, thank you very much. In terms of renting, which I'm feeling is what a lot of people will be needing, the rental portion will be handled by a housing association.
Yeah, all right, so then how many of them will there be?
Well, that's still under discussion, but...
Can't you just give a straight answer? We're asking questions, you ain't giving straight answers.
Gethin's made a very interesting point. Gethin, what we know is the rent will be higher than council houses at the moment, but lower than the market value.
So meaning most people in this room can't afford it, and you know that.
You know that
we're not sitting here with loads of money that we can just chuck us some flat.
Yeah.
Because all you've done, you've just shown us what we can't have. We ain't even asking for something that fancy. We just want something better.
I'm sleeping in my sister's shed, yeah? And she's fed up of it.
Listen.
My life, right? I want a zero-hour contract, which basically means I don't get paid anything because I work, 6 hours a week if I'm lucky. I've got a bed, I sleep on the mattress, right? There's no toilet, I have to piss in the bush. So I have to go around to fucking their house to have a shower. So why have I come here today if you can't offer me anything?
I understand your frustrations, I really do, but see, sir, these are your perceptions of what is going on.
Perception? My perception is I'm living in a fucking shed.
Look, if you...
Right? You're not taking down minutes of the meeting. Because you live here and it's forgotten. That young boy has been living in his sister's shed for a very long time. In town, in cold weather.
As your councillor, no one understands your problems more than I do. I listen to people on a daily basis. It is not right in this day and age that we have people on the streets. Miss, I register your passion. I register your anger.
It's all about passion, love. It's desperate people out there.
I understand that.
Yeah, can I ask a question? What about the indigenous population? I mean, if we're Muslim, they come in, they get everything. Setting up their own business advice. Driving lessons.
I don't really like it. What about him? I don't really like it. People like that.
Get off, please, ladies and gentlemen.
Seen people come in, I'm black, so I got no problem with race, and they're banging houses before me and my kids.
Exactly.
So don't go.
Exactly.
We are divided. These people want to live together in a decent home. They don't want to be fighting. They just want a home.
You are kidding yourself. We're all kidding ourselves if you think that you are going to get one of them. This is mad. Are you pleased with yourself that you've now shown us the first place that we can never have?
I'm happy to have a lively debate.
So you get the frustration of the people who are living in the same area as Gethin, and basically they're getting nothing. They're getting nothing. And the councillor, I mean, again, we know the back. I mean, the backstory is not actually made in the drama, but I guess those in the know will know. Councils haven't got the resources, you know, to do any of this. And this is as best that they can do. But in the drama, I think there is a danger that it tips over into, oh, politicians.
Yeah, that did bother me slightly because, I mean, I am a bit of a local government geek. I worked for a local government think tank for 3 years. It's something I'm very passionate about. And actually, most councillors are doing their best with very, very, very little. And, you know, the government have cut the housing budget. They cut the housing budget by 60%. You know, that's why there's no homes. And that's central government. But as Eric Pickle said at the time, they've devolved the axe. And people just blame the local council. And I felt that writing that councillor in such an unsympathetic way, and she was also clearly very middle class.
Yes, for that area.
And actually, I mean, some councillors are middle class and some councillors are not. Councillors aren't that unrepresentative because they do have to live in the borough at least. So I did feel that that was slightly cheap. And actually, there's a better story to be told where that councillor isn't the bad guy. Now, again, that's maybe my prejudice is coming through. But I just felt like that bit was unnecessary and it was a shame because the rest of it was so, felt so real. And I thought it was a shame to make that point slightly cheaply.
Although it was... I mean, in a way, to have had the councillor be along the lines that you suggested and maybe reflect what the reality of being a councillor and all of that is, and also to inform the person who's viewing it that this isn't necessarily her fault.
Yeah.
I think that would have gone against the whole thrust of the drama, which sort of, I mean, as I say right at the start, we both agreed independently how utterly miserable and hopeless. And I mean, it was just, I mean, to have a councillor say something a bit more, you know, against that narrative, that would.
I don't think a councillor would necessarily have to give hope.
No.
But I think if you had a councillor who was also struggling.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. They could they'd wanted to. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's. I don't want a false representation of a councillor either way.
No.
But I don't think that the I'm now off to my big house, sod the lot of you kind of thing, was necessary.
Yeah, and the third authority figure was the manager in fast food.
Jacob,
who was awful, and the worst.
Yes. Thing,
I mean, I don't know how real it is, but you know, in terms of he was always calling Gethin bro, mate. Mm. The people that were on the short on the zero contracts were all called associates.
Associates, yeah.
They were all partners, but obviously they weren't. I mean, it's just a joke. So yeah. I thought that was quite neat, sort of showing that kind of workplace that people have to operate in.
There was that extraordinary conversation between Jacob and Gethin where Jacob just says words but means nothing.
Mm.
And I was just like, and then he says at the end of it, do you know what I mean? And Gethin goes, yeah. It's quite clear he hasn't the first clue, yeah.
No, I think there was quite it was interesting the way in which these authority figures used language that was just completely generic and managerial speak and alienating, but just to cover up the reality as presented in the drama that it was for Gethin. I mean, he was being screwed over at work, screwed over by the DWP, and the council wasn't offering him anything, you know. But they're all saying it in a certain kind of language which is meant to soften the blow. So I thought that was kind of neat.
I thought also the character of Gethin's father was very interesting. A former squaddie who had then worked as a television repairman, I think, possibly in a television factory. And then but by the time we meet him, he's homeless and living on the streets.
Yes, as he calls himself, a ghost.
A ghost, yeah.
On the street.
And I mean, I didn't think that was, you know, I think both... that fact, but also that's kind of a foreshadowing of Gethin's future. The kind of hopeless spiral of despair. I mean, we're recording this on the day that Theresa May leaves office. And what was running through my head watching him and Gethin was the Burning Injustices speech that Theresa May gave and then failed to live up to when she first went into Downing Street. And, you know, the fact that you are defined by birth so much in this country, and that, you know, Gethin seemed bright, he was a hard worker, he was enthusiastic, and yet he just couldn't get a break.
Yes, I mean, I don't know the reality of the situation, but I just thought, why is somebody so, you know, intuitive, so clearly intelligent? Why is he like that? I guess because of his family background. His mother died. His father was an alcoholic. Clearly, I think we're meant to assume carrying over certain things about maybe being in the army and, of course, being made redundant. So that maybe explains that. In one ways it was really crude, I thought, but in other ways it was kind of sophisticated. It was trying to give different perspectives, because we also got to know the Muslim family that moved over the road, and he did establish a relationship with Yaz, and we knew that I mean the brother, her brother that set up the halal butchers, and her mother with MS, wasn't it? And you know,
yeah.
And they'd been abandoned by their father, who'd run off with a bingo caller or something like that. We did get a sense of what it felt to be on the other side of all of this. So it wasn't just about Gethin and his mates who become radicalised. It's also about how the people who are being the ones radicalised against respond.
Yeah, because, I mean, the ratcheting up of what happens is that, first of all, Gethin and his mates go and attack the butchers and just kind of make a bit of a mess. They break a window, but it's not that major. Then, of course, Gethin is set about by the owner of the butchers, and is beaten up quite badly. And then that spirals into them setting fire to the butchers while the brother is asleep in it, which Gethin knew because Yaz had told him the brother slept in the butchers. So, you know, he chose that.
Yeah, that's a fair assumption, but it's never quite made explicit that he knew or he realised. But certainly, given, I mean, he ends up in prison, presumably for manslaughter or murder, and that's that. And Gethin does not express any regret. That's probably part of the most depressing element of it.
And one of the things that depressed me most was I thought, well, at least he's got a roof over his head.
Well, that's true. Maybe because if you noticed, he deliberately takes off his pig mask. So, and then he looks up at the security camera so that he might, maybe that was it, you know. I mean, it wasn't made explicit, but.
No, that's certainly a choice that you can make in your head, though, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, no, absolutely. Absolutely. So yeah, somebody radicalised within 2 weeks, ends up murdering somebody. But what obviously in a drama, you make your choices as to how you want to present it. Obviously, I don't know how realistic that is. But there was no, because these people are self-radicalised, aren't they? I mean, there is some sharing of videos and posts and this, you know, about Muslim paedophile gangs and stuff like that, but there's no organization, there's
no they're not brought into a Tommy Robinson style thing, but yeah, that's all online, isn't it? And you do see that it's, you know, he's going through all the comments, and they film their first attack on the butchers and they put that online, and they get lots of positive affirmation as well as some negative comments as well.
Yeah. So, but I just wondered, you know, there was no organisation there. There were no people. They just radicalise themselves, which of course can happen. People do radicalise themselves by just looking at stuff on YouTube.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the rise in the far right, an awful lot of it comes from just single, lonely young men reading the wrong things on 4chan.
Yes, yeah.
You don't need, and that's the difference, I think, between the rise of the far right now and the rise of the far right in the 70s, where it was more politically organised.
Mm.
Now it's more organically organised through websites rather than by, I mean, you do have people like Tommy Robinson, obviously, but or Stephen Yaxley Lennon, to give him his real name. But it's you don't have to meet that person in real life to be radicalised by them.
No. I mean, so I just wondered what we thought of. I mean, it told a story. Yeah. We know that story is based on some kind of reality. What we meant to think about this? I mean, because after it was over, I mean, during the course of it, I mean, it was very well made.
Yeah.
I mean, I was, you know, I mean, if
it's possible
to say anything nice in terms of production of something about something so terrible, it was really nicely done, I thought. But in terms of what you take away from it, I mean, there wasn't anything. I mean, other than going, oh, God.
Yeah, I mean, I do slightly wonder with dramas like this. I mean, it wasn't a pleasant watch.
No.
You know, and I wonder, again, it's like the Ken Loach question that we keep coming back to. You know, who's watching this that's going to have their minds changed by it?
Mm.
And I wonder, yeah, what's the point? You know, is it to trigger more action? Is it to ask for more resources to tackle the far right? So it was great, as you say, in terms of the production value. It was a gripping drama. It made me think about people like Gethin more. I think setting it in Wales was a really interesting choice.
Yes, I was surprised it was,
But I just, I just come back to what now?
Because the basic sort of hypothesis was quite simple. It was basically if he's responding to this situation in the way that he is because the housing situation is found himself in, and his job's shit, right? Not very good. And so it's just basic material reasons for why he goes in that direction. That seems a bit. And so the solution would be more homes, better jobs.
Yeah.
I mean, that's.
And, you know, I mean, that is sort of the basic solution to an awful lot of society's ills, to be fair.
Yeah.
And in fact, if you employ people to build more homes, you'd have more jobs.
Well, yes. Although it doesn't mean you don't get racist builders.
Indeed.
You were doing very well, nicely, possibly do pop out to the odd EDL rally. You're absolutely right. I mean, maybe a lot of these problems would disappear if the right resources are devoted to the right kinds of communities. But is that going to happen anytime soon? I mean, even with a Jeremy Corbyn government, that's not going to happen anytime soon.
No, I mean, there needs to be, I mean, obviously radical change is something that I'm quite keen to see. But what do we do in the meantime under the Tories? Well, they are not going to do that. And things are liable to get a lot worse by the end of this year, given that we're very, very close to a no-deal Brexit.
Yes, depending on that. I was wondering who's watching this, because it went out, because it's a BBC Three kind of thing, and that's really just online, but it was on BBC One at 10:30 on a weekday evening. I mean, it's online, who is watching it?
And I have to say, until you raised it with me, which I would like to point out you did, and therefore we are no longer a dictatorship of Emma, as you accused me last month, I hadn't seen people talking about it.
Mm.
So, I mean, which is a shame in many ways. It deserves a wider audience.
No, I've not seen it talked about. There was just some random tweet, and I thought, oh, that looks interesting. And that was it.
Yeah.
That was it. So, I mean, yeah, it could be one of... I mean, you know, it could be like all those Ken Loach films that say something maybe quite worthy with a bit of Trotskyism thrown in. But the only people that are watching it are the people that already agree with the analysis. I mean, it might be a useful thing to show, you know, to a group of Gethin types at some venue and then start a discussion. But, that may be some use. But, yeah, the utility of it, the message, I just wondered about.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you on that, but I mean, maybe it was aimed at people like you and I so that we can think a bit more about these things. You know, there is probably value to that too. But I just, I ultimately found it deeply depressing, but not necessarily motivational.
No, Yeah, there was no hope. There was no little bit. I mean, it's one thing to kind of make your point. So, well, more and better houses, affordable houses, better jobs where people can afford houses as a consequence of the work. Then, I mean, other than going, well, we'll have a revolution or vote for Jeremy Corbyn. What can the viewer do?
Yeah, and that I think is the hardest part. Is like, you've told me this story, which is deeply moving.
Mm.
You've told me that hate crimes have gone up, which at the end they put the statistics up, and you know, huge increase in hate crimes in the last few years. But you haven't told me what to do.
No.
And you haven't given the kind of solution that has mass action. You know, as you say, you know, other than change society completely from top to bottom, what mass action is then? How do I do that?
Or individual action for the person who's watching. What can I as an individual do? Maybe that was a deliberate, well, look, that clearly was deliberate. Maybe they were afraid it might be too propagandistic and there were some stipulations that they couldn't do anything. So they were just left with this. I don't know, but I'm sure if they'd thought about it hard enough, they could have come up with some little sort of chink in that really bleak picture to give us some hope, you know.
I might donate some money to Hope Not Hate, but that's about as much as I can think of to do.
Yeah, because I was waiting at the end of the programme. Maybe it was when it was transmitted, but only because I saw it in iPlayer, you know, something to say, and if you're concerned with some of the issues raised in this programme, that might have been something. But I did notice when I Googled the programme that there is an organisation, I think, called Exit UK, of people that used to be in the far right and out of the far right, and they were kind of linking themselves to that programme. So maybe something like that, that's some kind of good might have come of that. But anyway.
Yes, because a lot of the people who are the best advocates for people like Hope Not Hate are those who've been there.
Yeah.
You know, it's always very moving to hear those stories. It's worth saying that nobody in the drama is very well off, apart from the councillor, possibly. And not everybody gets radicalised.
Well, his sister doesn't, does she? She starts off, you think she's going to go that way, and then she actually doesn't, you know.
Yeah. And Yaz, you know, she's still living in the council house next door. It's not like she's, you know, that much better off.
No.
She's got this, you know, disabled mother, brother who is a bit rude and a bit difficult.
But not that bad. I mean, she's defended. So, yeah, there are no real villains, really, are there? I mean, at least even when the people that do the bad things, you understand why they do it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think if nothing else, then I think having that human understanding of people who otherwise we just think of as scum and thugs is worth examining and thinking about.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think if only, I mean, maybe it was designed for Guardian readers who kind of fly off the handle at certain things and don't really think it through. And if that's kind of giving some empathy and understanding, then great, that's fine. Because it was a good but grim drama. I don't know, you know, you'd have to watch it when you're feeling a bit strong about things.
Which I'm not sure that the morning that Boris Johnson becomes Prime Minister was really how I was feeling, but there you go.
But Boris is going to give us that hope that things can be done. Or maybe not.
Right, on that note, just to say, listeners, if you have any suggestions as to things that you'd like to see us cover, please do get in touch. I am EmmaBurnell_ on Twitter, and Steve is PolProfSteve, but we are also a ZT podcast. So please get in touch and suggest something cheery for us to watch.
Yeah. For summer, for August.
Something lovely and sunny.
Yeah.
In the meantime, thank you so much for tuning in. I've been Emma Burnell, and Steve has been Steve.
Always. I continue to be Steve, yes.
And do, if you have a moment, and if you've enjoyed this podcast, please, please do rate and review us on iTunes. And this has been a Political Human Production.